welcome to Minute 103 of The Great Escape Minute, the daily podcast where we dig into The Great Escape 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again is Father David Mowry, chaplain to the Movies by Minute community. Welcome back, Father David.
Now, if you ask me how far a podcast host dare go, whether he dare play God, I don't have an answer for you, other than a podcast host shouldn't go that far.
Okay. That works. So Minute 103 begins with Hendley continuing to try to convince Roger and goes all the way till Roger tries to actually explain himself.
I think Hendley makes a big mistake here where he doesn't try the classic "but come on" approach in all of his argumentation here.
Everyone else's parents let them go.
All the cool kids are going. Oh, why do you hate me, British Dad?
And I think, Richard Attenborough would play that part quite well. So, he's not in the grandfatherly, mode yet. This isn't Jurassic Park or Miracle on 34th Street, where, he's more of a grandfatherly type character who would let you get away with whatever you want, even if it means playing with dinosaurs and stuff like that. So,
what a very specific example. We need to do a little counseling here, Rob. You got some dirty laundry we need to air out here?
Nope, none at all.
Okay, all right. Well, very good.
That's if he wouldn't have acted that way, we wouldn't have had Jurassic Park. So,
that's true.
Or we wouldn't have had the problems in Jurassic Park. So there you go. Yesterday, we continued the debate between Hendley and Roger about whether Blythe should go. And we pointed out the fact that Blythe is just sitting there, as a dumbstruck child, letting the two parents have this argument above him. At the tail end of yesterday's minute, we discussed the fact that Hendley just saying that he knows that Colin has thought about getting back to his family and children establishes the strong connection between the two of them, and the fact that they've apparently had deeper conversations about their families and their hopes and dreams and stuff like that. And this minute continues with that, because basically what Hendley continues to say here is, he goes, well, I've also thought about it. And then he says something very interesting. He says, we think we can make it all the way. Okay, which is a very interesting way for them to put it, because, here you have these two characters who've been in the same room. They've been roommates for a few months. They've obviously had a lot of time to talk, and they've discussed their different plans for how they're going to try and escape, apparently. But the fact that he uses the phrase "we" here says so much about Henley's character and his connection to Colin, and it also explains why he's advocating so much for his friend here. They've discussed this aspect. So you see, even that's one of the things I love about going through a movie minute by minute is that you can really try to cling on to these different ways, the phrases and the ways that people say certain things, because there's so much insight into it. And when you're watching this movie normally, you wouldn't necessarily catch something like this. You would hear him say, "We think we can make it," but you wouldn't really question it. You just let it continue moving along, just with that.
Now, is it possible that the British influence is rubbing off on Hendley a little bit, and he's using the royal "we" because he's so impressed with the British royal family, and he's grown in some self-importance, perhaps? So we think that it is best that we go according to our plans. Our ways are not your ways.
It's very possible, but I don't think that King Edward VI, who was a stutterer, would have said it this way. Who he was, he was the royal "we" at the time.
Oh, that's right. I recently just rewatched all this movie is happening. You're right.
That's right. I recently he's already cursed for a few years. I recently rewatched the King's Speech. So I have it very fresh in my mind. So it's funny that actually came up. But no, everything that happened in the King's Speech happened in 1939. It happened before the Declaration of War.
The king's been swearing for years. Okay. All right.
That's right. Got it. He's continuing to swear with Lionel.
The other possibility is that we think we can make it all the way. Yes, that speaks to Hendley and Blythe's relationship. But I think there's also a window into a small group of people in the camp who all share this same aspiration. I think there are the career escapers, those who are going to do their officer's duty to harass the enemy and are okay with getting caught again because they're just trying to make life difficult for the Germans. But I think there are also the dreamers, the romantics who are a part of this escape, who think this time we're going to make it all the way. We're going to be able to get all the way back home. And Hendley represents the romantic escapees, those who think they can make it as far as possible and have a goal beyond the instrumental goal of making life difficult for Nazis, which, of course, is always a good goal.
Yes.
But sometimes we can have more goals.
That's correct. You can mix up the goals together.
A little bit of this, a little bit of that,
you know. Mm-hmm. No, that's a very valid point that you're making. And that's, again, as I mentioned earlier, that's why I love dissecting a film like this, because there are ambiguous meanings to this phrase, and they all actually make sense. Mm-hmm. You know, and they can give us so much insight into the things that happen to the characters between the scenes.
Yeah,
which adds so much to the thing. I mean, they do a great job here developing these characters as is, and these phrases help even more. There's no question about that. Mm-hmm. And at this point, Roger responds and says, "No, not Colin. He'd be an appalling hazard to the escape. That must be my decision." Again, as I mentioned earlier this week. Exactly. But as I mentioned earlier this week, I actually agree with Roger in this point, because he's making a very valid point here. You know, yes, he wants to get home, and there are a lot of people who want to get home. You know, whether the we is referring to just Henley and Colin, or if the we is referring to the royal we, or whether the we is referring to all the prisoners, regardless, Colin is in danger of endangering everyone else.
Right. And Roger is simply doing his duty as the commanding officer of this operation. He cannot he cannot let the concerns of one individual outweigh the good of the whole operation. And so he has to be willing to make these hard decisions to say, this individual is too much of a risk to the greater good. And we want to get 250 people out of this prison. And that operation has a greater chance of success if we do not have a blind man trying to make that escape, because it's going to mean that he's going to be difficult to get out of the place with the tunnels and the whole system that we see set up. If he was trying to navigate that while blind, that would slow that operation down, to say nothing of what happens if he actually gets out. And now he's, like I said earlier this week, he'd be a babe in the woods, almost literally. He could just get exactly. Right into the trees and wouldn't be able to tell the difference between a Nazi gunner and an elm tree.
Well, if the elm tree starts shooting back, then he can sort of make a differentiation between them. But I think
I don't know, I've met some pretty aggressive elm trees.
I think what you said fits in with, can say that this is what Spock would say. You know, Spock's quote is, logic clearly dictates that the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few.
Or the one.
And Kirk responds, or the one. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that fits in here, because that's the idea, that we mm-hmm. want to get as many out as possible. If some blunder happens and nobody gets out, then we've done this all for naught. And the idea is to raise the possibility of as many prisoners as possible getting out here.
Yeah, now here we are as armchair generals commenting on this operation. But if in the movie itself, as the audience member, your heart is pulled toward Blythe. He strikes a very pathetic figure, and he's a very sympathetic person, and we want him to escape because he doesn't really belong in this setting. He's not a real military officer like Hendley or Danny or Willie are. He's a civilian who's been caught up in military service. And as the audience, we want him to escape because he doesn't belong there. Of course, we want everyone to escape, but we're emotionally willing to overlook the logic of Roger's argument, because, well, look at him. Look at the poor. He's just sitting there. He's helpless. He's just got that big egg head, and you just want to give him a great big hug and tell him it's all going to be okay.
Exactly. But again, the question is how is one supposed to look at this? Are we supposed to? I guess I like the fact that you can look at it from both perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can see Colin's perspective, but you can also see Roger's perspective, and you can see Henley's perspective. We actually have three perspectives here. Even though Colin and Henley's are similar, they're not completely aligned.
Mm-hmm.
Because we don't yet know, you know, how Colin is actually going to be able to get around. And I have a feeling that Colin himself doesn't even know the answer to that question. Henley is advocating, but he hasn't at this point. You know, later in the week, he will actually give us a suggestion as to how this is going to work. But he's only forming right now the thought in his mind of how he, you know, of how this is going to work.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not been mentioned outright, which, you know, it does leave the viewer with a lot of questions and doubt as to how this is going to possibly happen.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, as you said, Roger puts his foot down because he says this must be my decision. And again, that goes back to what you were mentioning earlier this week about, you know, military command and, you know, the how that works. And it's interesting that Roger's even debating this as opposed to saying, I'm the commander. This is it. There's no, you know, there's no question here. Mm-hmm. You know, he's still allowing this debate to go on. I think it's more for the audience, you know, to give the audience the different variables and possibilities here. You know,
like Bartlett's rank is what, flight commander?
Bartlett
flight leader
is a flight. He's squadron leader.
Squadron leader. So he's squadron leader. And do we ever establish what Hendley's rank is? Is he a captain?
Yeah, we know the ranks of every one of these characters.
Okay, I'm just curious how close they are in the military hierarchy. Because if Bartlett was talking to some ensign, just, you know, to some fresh faced recruit, it would be, listen here, Sonny, you got to listen to me because I'm your commanding officer. Is it because the Hendley is an officer of sufficient rank that they have more of a conversation around this?
Okay, well, Roger's an OF3, which is
a
squadron officer, and mm-hmm. and Hendley is an OF2. He's a flight lieutenant. So there is one rank between the two of them. I mean, there is Roger's basically one rank above him.
Yeah. So
according to what I understand of the whole thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, unless there's a whole cavalcade of ranks in between OF2 and OF3 that we're unaware of, but probably they're just one rank apart. So that plus the unusual circumstances of a prisoner of war escape demanding more camaraderie and a little more consensus, because you want everyone to be on the same page and everyone to go along with the plan, because if one person is not on board, it's going to screw it up for everybody. And you're stuck with them. Now, you can't send them to another assignment. It's not like other places in the military where you can get rid of problematic officers. So maybe those things, the closeness of rank and the need to get consensus and everyone on the same page, is what gives Roger, he gives himself permission to have more of a conversation around this. And Roger gets very philosophical here, just musing on the nature of military command itself. Because...
Right.
Military commanders do have to make very difficult decisions that touch directly upon whether soldiers live or die. And that is a position I do not envy anyone to have to carry out. The moral calculations and the tactical considerations required in that are very difficult. And even more so when you are completely within the control of the enemy. You know, the Luftwaffe have been very gentlemanly up to this point and pretty lenient when it comes to letting prisoners smoke and have chocolates in their rooms and steal passports and all that kind of stuff. But they could turn on a dime. You could get a new commandant tomorrow and life would be a living hell. So Roger is trying to make the best of a very bad situation.
Right. So I just quickly looked through all the ranks of all the characters here. And what's interesting is that the majority of the characters are either OF2s or OF1s.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have Ramsey, who's an OF5. And then you have, there are two characters that are OF3s. You have Roger and Ashley Pitt, which I never would have thought Ashley Pitt was so highly ranked.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. So there might only be one rank between the two of them, but apparently it's a big jump between those
yes.
two.
Yes.
You know, by going from being a flight lieutenant to the squadron leader.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So at this point, then Henley brings up the whole idea about hazard. He says, all right, you want to talk about a hazard? Let's talk about you.
Mm-hmm.
You're the biggest hazard we have. The Gestapo has you marked. Now, just because the Gestapo has it marked, I have trouble following his logic here. Okay? You're a prisoner in a prisoner of war camp. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
If you get out, so you're a higher priority. So I don't know how that makes it that they're a hazard. I mean, is he trying to say basically that, okay, let's talk about Bin Laden, okay? Bin Laden was one of the highest top 10 FBI list or whatever you want to call it. You know, he was number one. So if Bin Laden was Roger and Bin Laden gets out of a camp, so there is the logic here that he's saying, okay, if Bin Laden gets out, then they're going to devote even more of their resources to trying to stop everyone because they want to also capture Bin Laden?
Who all escaped? Oh, 250 people escaped. Okay, fine. But did Bartlett escape? No, he's still here. Oh, okay, then never mind.
No, again, I think you reached my point. If anything, it would work the opposite way. Meaning that if Bartlett escaped, okay, we're going to even send more troops to try to stop them.
Now, I wonder, as I'm thinking about the rest of the movie, and I don't know how firmly you hold to the movies by the minute covenant of not talking about future minutes, but
no, we can talk about them.
Thinking about what happens to the vast majority of the escapees, would they have met that kind of grisly end had it not been Bartlett who was in charge of that escape? Because they raise the stakes for him when he shows up at the camp. You escape, next time you will be shot. And the Gestapo make good on that threat by the end of the movie. If Bartlett hadn't escaped, would the same punishment have been meted out to all of the escapees that they had rounded up?
I believe so. Mm. I think the idea was that the Gestapo felt the embarrassment of so many of these prisoners getting out. And that's mm-hmm. why they said, okay, we want to put a stop to this. And what we're going to do is we're killing millions of other people. So why not kill 50?
That's a fair point. I wonder from Henley's point of view whether Bartlett escaping just puts other escapees at risk of being caught in the crossfire.
Yeah.
Because he knows that Bartlett is such a high priority target, whereas he's just an OF2. He's just some guy in the British Royal Air Force. He's looking out for his own neck, perhaps.
True, but they're all going to be scattering in different directions. I mean, this isn't that they're all going out. They're not going out in a group of 250. So again, I have a little trouble understanding the full logic. I realize why this debate is important because it's again telling the viewer something bad could happen because Roger's part of this also. But I'm not 100% sold that that's the main reason why it happened. And you know, it goes back to what you were saying before about, you know, the respect of command, you know, that you have Henley say, no one said you can't go. Now, I wouldn't necessarily say someone would say that to their, to their commanding officer. That's something that's going to get you a slap and, possibly even a little bit of KP.
Yeah, right.
And then Roger actually has a convincing argument back. You know, he says, that's true. I've thought a lot about the Gestapo. But if you're asking me how far a commanding officer is allowed to go. So again, he's bringing up the whole idea of military command. You know, the commanding officer is the one who makes these decisions or dare go. Or should he be permitted to play God? As you mentioned, I think we discussed this a little bit yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it goes a little too far by saying the fact that he can play God, but it's the idea that, okay, every commanding officer or any business manager, you know, it's not the same type of stakes, but you're the one who makes the decision of who's doing what.
Sorry, so I'm just imagining this same speech coming out of Michael Scott's mouth on The Office, and it's completely the kind of thing that I could see Michael Scott saying. How far dare a regional manager go? Dare he play God? I could see that being played off for laughs, but yeah, the stakes would be far lower at Dunder Mifflin than they are at the Luftwaffe camp.
Correct, but it still goes with the same basis of the manager or the commanding officer is the one who decides who's doing what task. The repercussions or the dangers of that task are obviously different, but it still falls into the same area of, you know, of in, I can understand why they use the phrase playing God, mm-hmm. because it's the idea of you're saying, okay, I mean, there's something that Saving Private Ryan deals so much with, you know, and throughout the whole movie about, you know, sometimes you have to just make a blind decision and say, okay, you're going to go do this, you're going to go do that. And I guess hope for the best. That's what it comes to. You're gonna choose the best person for that particular job,
right?
Hoping that they're gonna succeed in doing that. And that's basically what a commanding officer or a manager needs to do.
I think the God talk comes in because, like I said earlier, this touches upon whether soldiers live or die, and that right. power of life and death. We, with reverence ascribed to God, we see God as the author of life and as the only one who could have any claim to legitimacy when it comes to deciding who lives and who dies. And so for someone with a limited perspective, even with as much information as Bartlett has, he doesn't know how everything's going to play out. He doesn't know how this escape is going to go. And he's going to dare to play God to decide who lives and who dies based on the very limited information that he has. Still, someone has to make that decision. Someone has to be willing to examine what's available and make the choice that's going to serve the overall goals of this escape operation.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it makes sense. Roger's explanation fits, especially in this type of situation. Mm-hmm. And he admits himself that he can't answer if what he's doing is the right thing or the wrong thing, but as a commanding officer, that's what you have to do. Mm-hmm. And what he can say, he says, I can't tell you what's going to happen to everybody, but what I can say is that having a blind man is an unnecessary hazard to both himself and to the whole plan, which, again, I have to agree with Roger on this point.
Yeah.
You know, you have a blind guy stumbling around. If part of the whole idea of stealth, that you want it to be, it's going to take as long as possible before the guards or the authorities are notified of the fact that you're escaping. So if you have a blind man, the odds are that you're gonna lessen that amount of time, because he's just gonna stumble around mm-hmm. until he gets caught. And he basically says that's the reason why he needs to just be eliminated from this operation. I think eliminated is a very strong term to use.
Yes. There. Given the camp circumstances, eliminated carries a little more weight than usual.
Yeah. And then they show us, you know, Blythe just like for a fraction of a second. Mm. And you see he does have this lost puppy dog look on his face.
Sad.
Yeah. Like he doesn't really know. He hasn't responded at all. Mm-hmm. He's letting Henley do all of his fighting for him here. It's still a great debate. They're doing a good job here of trying to give the viewer numerous perspectives on how this could potentially work. All right. Well, as we mentioned, this is Donald Pleasence Appreciation Week. You want to highlight a different one of his movies every day. So what movie do you have for us today?
Yes, well, I think people who've been paying attention could have seen this one coming, and given my own professional interest, it should come as no surprise that the next movie that I want to talk about that Donald Pleasence played a role in is The Greatest Story Ever Told, released in beautiful Cinerama in 1965. The original cinematic cut was 4 hours, 20 minutes long. And Donald Pleasence is not the starring role in this, though I would love to see his interpretation of Jesus of Nazareth. That would be a very interesting cinematic role. No, rather, Donald Pleasence is not playing the main character. He is playing Satan in this role and appears primarily in the temptation scenes as Max von Sydow, playing Jesus of Nazareth, is tempted by the obsequious and honey-tongued devil played by Donald Pleasance to give up on the task that God the Father has given to him. So this is a movie that perhaps many of our listeners have already seen, but I find it really interesting to see Donald Pleasance's range here, where we get those hints of Bond villain coming through in his interpretation of Satan.
I actually am one of those people who has seen this movie. Can't say that I really appreciate it, but that could also be because of my religious background, where I am not as familiar with the entire story as you would be, you know, being Jewish. I liked the epic aspect of the way they portrayed this story.
Oh, yeah, this is big Hollywood. This is the mid-1960s. Yeah. We are going big. These are the Marvel movies of their day, these big sword and sandal epics. And unfortunately, this way of making movies is not going to hold for very much longer. Cleopatra's on the horizon. No,
Cleopatra came out beforehand. Didn't Cleopatra come out in 63?
Was that 63?
I believe so.
I always had 66 in my head. I defer to your greater expertise. Yes, you're right. It was 63. Oh, so we're in the beginning of the end here then with Cleopatra. We have the slow downfall of these big movies.
I actually enjoyed Cleopatra much more than I did The Greatest Story Ever Told.
Well, if only you could go back to 1963 and spend lots of the box office, because that's what the movie studios were paying attention to.
All right. Well, you have anything else for this minute?
No, not for this minute.
Okay. All right. So you want to come back and spend Thanksgiving with us tomorrow?
Well, you know, I have a very full schedule eating turkey and falling face first into stuffing, but I think I can make some time for my old friend Donald Pleasance on Thanksgiving Day. So I would love to come
back.
What
about for me? What about for all of our listeners?
Oh, yeah, you are the listeners too. Sure, of course. Yeah, no, I'm kidding. Yeah, of course. I'd love to spend Thanksgiving with all of you.
So why don't you tell everyone once again how they can get in touch with
you? You can find me on Twitter. You can reach me at Father Mowry. That's at FRMOWRY. And I would love to hear some of your Thanksgiving recipes. What are some of the foods that you put on your table that remind you of home and make you feel real cozy?
All right, great. And while you're doing that, you can go rate, review, and subscribe on any podcatcher that you might be using to listen to this show. You can visit our website, thegreatescapeminute.com. Our Twitter account is greatescapemxm. Our email is thegreatminute@gmail.com. And our Facebook group is The Cooler. So, until tomorrow, tally-ho!
Tally-ho!